Welcome, warrior. You are listening to Bound by Honor, the Klingon Assault Group Book Review Podcast. Your hosts, Juvon Tai Doon Yi Soon Sin, Jorn Vestai Vampyr, and Jajim Tai Jajim, will explore Klingon culture as it appears in Star Trek literature. Perhaps you yourself can hear the cry of your inner warrior. If so, go to www.kag.org and make your presence known. Learn how to join the Klingon Assault Group and begin your journey along the way of the warrior. Now, here are your hosts, Kapla. Welcome to Bound by Honor, the Klingon Book Review Podcast. And tonight, I am here with my co-hosts, Jorn and Juvon. Say hello, guys.
Hello, guys.
Hello, guys.
Okay. Tonight we're going to take a look at The Final Reflection, a Star Trek Original Series Book 16 by John M. Ford. And just to give a real brief summary on the book, in the framing story, Dr. McCoy returns to the Enterprise from shore leave, and he's brought with him a new novel called, ironically enough, The Final Reflection. He hands a copy of this to Captain Kirk, who promises to read it. And the story itself contains an account of how war was avoided between the Klingon Empire and the Federation thanks to the efforts of an officer named Kren, who is a brilliant military strategist and learns the value of peace. As a result of Kren's intervention, the Klingon Empire is able to obtain information on the use of dilithium and antimatter, and that allows the Empire to enhance their weapons and engines. Kren has risked his life to keep the Empire out of an apparently unwinnable war. Starfleet denies that any of the events in this novel have taken place and calls it a work of complete fiction. So that kind of lays the background for the book.
In fact, didn't they mention in the before book and after book segment that this was a banned book by the Federation?
It may have. If it did, I don't remember that myself.
And we found recently that John Haversall, the founder of KAG, has been talking this particular book up without knowing we were going to do this particular review on his Facebook page, mainly because this book and the FASA gaming modules are the literature that he used to put the rituals and rules together for the KAG Klingon Assault Group fan club.
Oh, he didn't actually know. I thought he wrote that article because we were doing it.
Oh, he started writing the subsequent articles were because I mentioned that we were doing this book as a podcast after he did the first couple.
Oh, that's cool. And kind of random.
Yeah, I thought that was kind of neat that he was pushing the book. And I thought it was as a result of us going to be talking about it. So let's start off with our overall impressions of the book. Tell you what, John, I'll let you go first.
This book was written in 1984. That's the same year that Star Trek III, The Search for Spock, came out. So that's the same year that we got a larger exposure to Klingon whole or the Klingon language. So a lot of the words that John uses in his book are not the same words that Mark created for Star Trek III and the Klingon language that follows. So there's a lot of misconception differences, let's say. But another way to look at those differences is we saw the same thing in The Savage Curtain, where the aliens dredged up Kalis out of Kirk and Spock's memories, where they didn't have a fully fledged image of Kalis the Unforgettable. And so we get that kind of a modern looking Klingon in the original series episode. Probably seeing the same thing here, where the writer is trying to use words that sound Klingon, but gives a spice that they're talking Klingon.
Yeah, I saw a lot of differences and was really happy to see that explanation of how things had transpired. Tell you what, I thought the book was good, but I don't think I liked it as much as everybody else seems to like it. And I think that's probably because I'm used to the more recent Star Trek novels as opposed to the others. Sean, what did you think?
I agree with Jim. The book only really works for me because of the framing. If they didn't have the parts with Kirk at the beginning and the end, I think this book was a little rushed, especially in the center after he gets adopted and before he becomes a captain and goes on this peace mission. I found the center part where he was moving up for the ranks didn't really work too much for me, but when you take into account that this is based off of one, maybe two people's accounts of a real life event, mainly from somebody who heard this guy's life story. So from that point of reference, the book does work for me, but I do agree. It's not, I don't personally enjoy it as much as other people do, but I do appreciate what it is.
Yeah, I agree with that. Well, anything else to add to that particular, the overall impressions?
I don't think so. If we move on into the characters at this point, obviously we've got Kirk, Spock, and McCoy. But interestingly enough, through the course of this book, we're going to see in the section of the book that is in the middle, not the end pieces, we see Spock as a child interacting with Kern at this point. And we have Dr. McCoy, or Bones, referred to by his grandfather in one of the meetings that Kern has on Earth. Obviously, the main character of this book starts out as Vern, then has the V in his name changed to K and becomes Kern as he's adopted by the Thought Admiral of the time after he participates in a game of Klingza Kenti, or live action Klingza.
Okay, so that was one of the neat parts of the book for me, as they were talking about the Klingza game with live players. There were deaths involved in there too, weren't there?
At least massive maimings, to the point where one character ends up having to be frozen all the time because his nerves had to be repaired in such a way that they are moving so fast that he's burning up his life cycle.
I was very interested with what they were doing to fix people. Like there was one Klingon, I want to say it was Kelly, that there was something wrong with her shoulder. It wasn't until she hooked up with senior Thomas McCoy that she was finally able to get fixed properly. I think it was a side of Klingons that hasn't really been explored too much, is the medical side of their culture.
I think when we get into the Gorkon series of books, one of the main characters there is a Klingon surgeon who is very interested in bringing Klingon medical practices as far forward as she can. And she deals with why Klingon warriors don't take kindly to doctors fixing them up.
Yeah, she's not very well appreciated for her abilities in that series of books, and it causes her some problems.
But getting back to this book, another, like I said, there's the character Zarn, who gets really damaged in one of the games that they're doing, or in the particular game they're doing in the beginning. And when they repair him, his reflexes and everything are sped up to like five times human, four times normal Klingon. And to keep his life cycle within anywhere of a useful function, they have to freeze him between missions, a lot like what we saw with the Winter Soldier in the Captain America movies. And the same thing, he doesn't remember anything of his previous missions or his previous lives between the times he's frozen.
Isn't he described somewhat as an assassin?
Basically, I think his mission, I think where you get this from, is his mission to Earth was to do a couple of assassinations.
So what other Klingon characters do we have that are interesting? I was really impressed with Kethis Epitai Kamara, Vren's adoptive father, and his lifestyle was very interesting. It seemed very relaxed and somewhat not very Klingon-like.
He was the Thought Admiral. He was the Grandmaster of the Game of Klinzaa. And he did have an Orion as a consort.
Yeah, that was very interesting. But, the description of his home sounded very much like kind of a country resort. You know, I would expect a Klingon to live a more Spartan lifestyle, more based on battle.
Well, remember, too, this was written by a human getting details that he could from the Klingons.
Yeah, that is an interesting thing about the book. Anything that you're kind of like, well, that's kind of weird, could always be kind of brushed off as this is a person writing a book from account of another person who knew a person.
Did you notice that the name of the planet was not Kronos, but Klin-ha or something along that lines? And that the cities were not what we heard about later, First City, but they had different names, like Emperor's City or something like that.
I thought that was kind of cool. And, I know the Klingha thing kind of, it's also in Heart of Glory, the first TNG Klingon episode, they just referred to as Kling, the homeworld. So Kronos didn't really come around until Star Trek VI, I believe.
Yeah, I'm not exactly sure when it popped in, but we did see Klin being used a lot in this book to refer to things. And it sounded, I was getting the impression that Klin had a lot to do with either the soul of a Klingon or the honor or spirit of a Klingon.
And that is one of the things that this book did do very well. And it gave an impression of the Klingons something other than we had from the original series, which were just ruthless, conquering, battle-crazy people. And it did give them a sense of honor and a sense of worth. It stopped them from being just stock villains and gave us a different picture of Klingon society. And I can see why this book would be the foundation for what comes later.
Well, as we go through the book and Kern advances, we find him in charge of the IKV fencer as the captain of the ship. After several missions where we see him on, where he's doing raids, particularly on the Romulans, he's recalled to the Klingon homeworld to take on a multi-year mission to go to Earth, pick up a Dr. Emmanuel Tegor, and bring him back to be the Federation ambassador to the Klingon Empire.
Yeah, and this guy had a total sense of, he didn't want anything to do with conflict. He was totally into solving problems and getting people to get along, which kind of surprised me that they would send someone who understood battle. He did understand conflict quite well, but had a big aversion to it.
Did you notice the book that they mentioned he was reading?
I think I did. I don't remember.
Mark Twain's Innocence Abroad.
Okay. Yeah, I do remember. I do remember Mark Twain being mentioned.
But it's basically his travelogue when he went overseas for some time with a group of people and discovered the Earth, as it were.
Ah.
Later, we have the fencer being met at the border between the Federation and the Klingon Empire by a fleet of Federation ships commanded by Admiral Luther Whitetree. And I thought it was interesting that one of the things that he mentioned to Kern was the fact that his son had been killed by the Klingons, or at least supposedly killed by the Klingons, because there was no survivors to let him know, which harkens to the movies that we're seeing coming out of that particular time.
Yeah, Kirk's son was killed by Klingons.
I kind of like the idea that the Klingons, especially Kern, or I guess Vern at this point, or no, sorry, he was Vern, and now he's Kern at this point. That he's kind of playing a long game. Everything he does is playing a long game, which I do feel like is supposed to be the ultimate theme of this thing, and why the final reflection was the game that he played with his stepfather all the time. Is that while everybody's they're thinking of more of a long like it's a very long term game that he's playing. Like he realizes that the Federation doesn't know that they have transporters, so he doesn't give up that knowledge until it's convenient for him to do it.
Until he can actually make a dramatic show to show up the fact that the Federation introduces the fact that they have transporters, and at the same time find the weakness in the Federation transporters.
Yeah, and it's cool that they actually address the fact that the Federation's teleporters do have this kind of a whining sound. Now, in the movie, the Klingons' teleporter have an even louder whining sound, but probably when the guy wrote the book, he didn't know that would be a factor in the movie. And I also, some of the issues that I did have with this book, which, you know, it's kind of like with this guy talking about his son and all that, I feel like there's a lot of interesting stories that are happening around the main character. And some of them, I really feel like there's like a good two, three, four other books that they have in here that they could have written entire stories about off of something that was dropped in this book. And it would have been cool to have seen this book to go on to be like a series of, they just keep on peeling back the layers of the Klingon culture, like talk about where this particular admiral's son had died, and, you know, maybe going into what actually happened to Kern's stepfather, what happened to his parents. It would have been interesting to see more of this stuff actually explored and more culture building done for the Klingon Empire.
I think we're looking at, though, a product of its times. About a 250-page book was considered actually a fairly thick book at that particular time. You're looking at about 200 pages for your normal paperback.
Oh, I'm not complaining about the length of the book. I said it would have been interesting if they have made other books that tied into this based off of one of these stories expanded on and made that into a book.
So, Sean, you think there was a lot more in this book, and the stories, I thought the book was just very, very busy, and you would start to follow this thread and it would kind of drop off, and it wasn't really clear where some of the things were going.
Oh, 100%. That is the case. And I think that leads back to the idea that this is a book that somebody's written based on somebody else's accounts of somebody else's life.
Yeah, one of the impressions I had is that the book was written based on reports of actual events, but then novelized in order to allow it to be distributed.
And there was the author's notes at the beginning that Kirk read, he thanked the doctor, Emil, for his help with his firsthand accounts. And I think that's where a lot of the kind of idea of like where the first, that's why they can't decide whether these are actually true stories or if it's something that the author completely made up. And I think there might be more truth to it, but it's a question of how much Kern actually told the doctor versus and whether or not he was ever actually truthful to him.
I got the feeling that Kern was fairly truthful with Emmanuel. Maybe not everybody else, but he looked on Emmanuel as being a mentor or a teacher of sorts, and learned a lot. And I learned a lot from him, and that's, I think, what brings us all the way around when we get to it, to the final confrontation that Kern has with other Klingons.
I definitely saw Emmanuel as a mentor for Kern, and he taught him a lot of the better side of humanity, where Kern had plenty of opportunities to see the bad side of it. You know, there was a lot of intrigue and things going on behind people's backs around here in this book that could have really blown up in everybody's face.
You had the protesters almost lining all the way from where they landed in the West Coast through their trip to Atlanta into Florida for their first meetings. In addition to, like you said, all the intrigue that was going on the Federation side, whether it was the Back to Earth movement or the We Need to Keep the Federation Together movement.
All right, since we're moving on to what happened to Earth, when I was reading this, the main thing that I had running through my head is, how much did Gene Roddenberry actually was involved in the book series? Because I don't feel like if you just look at just the original series, you don't really know much about what's happening on Earth. So this could potentially be happening on Earth, but when you take everything into account, this book is obviously out of continuity. But when I was reading it, I was just like, you know, even in the context of watching the original series and like the first three seasons of TNG, which is clearly Gene Roddenberry's vision of the future, I just don't see Earth being like this. So I am very curious. To me, it feels like Gene Roddenberry had no involvement in the books at all, but maybe I'm wrong.
I believe he had a little bit of involvement in the books, not the extent that Lucas had with the Star Wars books. But also remember that almost all the events, except the front few pages and the back few pages, took place while Bones was an infant.
Yeah, which would be 40 years ago, maybe 50. And I'm kind of confused that if you have the ability for interstellar travel, I get that they want him to land where the nuclear test site was to kind of make a statement, then it seems like they're on a train forever. And it's like, why is this train so slow? Like, if you have the ability to warp between planets, why is it taking you forever to move across the continent?
Let me take that one. How else are you going to travel on this particular type of Earth? Well, probably by transporter. And if you're going to be hiding your transporters, you need to go to an alternate form of transportation. And your alternate form of transportation, with a new technology surpassing it, is probably going to be antiquated. Now, of course, that whole line of reasoning falls apart because we've got Admiral Marcus Van Damien later on in the book being killed on the train that he's riding on.
See, now one would think that Starfleet personnel at least would have access to expensive for them to use it.
I'm fine with not using the transport. I just don't understand why they had to take a train. Why didn't they just hop in a shuttle and fly to that place? It's just like one of those things where it's like you said, it kind of goes off in this weird tangent. And it feels like it was obviously excused so that they could address the political landscape of Earth at the time. But to me, it's kind of like, well, what's the point? Like you're basically the military. You can't get a shuttle out here to fly the guy across the country.
So then the train was just a plot device which I guess to show the climate, the anti-Klingon climate, and then, of course, the movement to purge Earth of aliens, dissolve the Federation, and become xenophobic, you know, it allowed that element to come through.
And let me back up that plot device idea with, if the Federation wants to give Kern and, at this point, Akeel, his first officer, a feel for the landscape of Earth, a train's a really good way to go. You don't see much from, say, an airplane, a.k.a. shuttlecraft, thousands of feet in the air.
That's fine. They must assume that Kern was more important than he really was to the High Council, because, like, if the Emperor came, I could see wanting to show him the climate, but it's just one of those things where it's like, okay, they have an anti-Earth movement. You couldn't get that across in a news clip or something like that. They had to spend forever on a train.
Don't know. That's what they decided to. That's what John Ford decided to do, though. So that's what we've got.
Yeah,
it also allowed them to take the detour and talk to Maxwell Grandison, who was the leader of the Back to Earth movement, who didn't leave Atlanta.
I actually, for as weird as everything that involved him was, I actually really enjoyed his parts. It was interesting to actually see, because they kind of dive into it a little bit in Enterprise, that Back to Earth movement or Isolate Earth movement. It was kind of interesting to see him sit there and want to send back that message, only for Kern to end with, well, if this is really what you want them to tell you, we're just going to assume that you're weak and ripe for invading.
And that was the Klingon, I don't want to say mythology, but the thought process of the time. They were still in the, we need to expand to live. And if another culture doesn't want to expand also, then they must want us to come in and make, what was it, coups of them.
Well, are there any other characters in here that were interesting and worth looking at?
Oh, I had to go back, and I finally found him in the second reading. You'd mentioned him earlier. Carter Winston was a character in one of the negotiations in the last third of the book. He was a character in one of the episodes of the animated series, or not so much him, but an alien impersonating him was a character in the animated series. And apparently he shows up in another of the, or he's talked about in another of the Star Trek books, the face of the unknown.
Okay. You know, one thing I would like to know a little more about myself is this game of Klinza, which was, for me at least, the favorite part of the book whenever they were playing this game.
I thought it was cool that it's like a game with a set of rules, but then you have a ton of variations of the board. And then on top of that, they've adapted it to like a live action version of the game where you move around the pieces and then you move around the players. And then when the players get to intersecting spots, then they battle instead of just certain pieces knocking out other ones.
Basically, what you've got is you've got the standard game of Klinza. You've got the reflective game for Klinza. You've got the perpetual game of Klinza. You got the ablative game and the clouded game. And there are separate rules for each. And there's a website out there. I don't have the actual link right now. We can get it added later on at the usual place where we put links. But somebody has come up with rules for all of these games and how to play them, including Klinza Kente, which is the live action game that you were talking about, which can again be done in various versions. You can have the open game of it, or as described in the book, they were playing a clouded game of it.
So have either one of you guys ever played this game?
Nope.
I built the board, I built the pieces, but I've never gotten around to playing it.
I would be interested. I enjoy playing games. I would be interested in learning how to play it. So I might look it up and see if I can figure it out.
Oh, there's a guy in the Crimson Fleet who has a board, or has designed his own board and has rules. It would be cool that the interesting thing about it is that there are even in the book, there's tons of variations. So if people were to just like make their own boards, tweak the rules so it works for their boards, that would be pretty cool to see more people take advantage of it.
Yeah, actually, the board that I built, I cut on the laser cutter, and it cuts into three pieces. So it's a really big board, but it folds down into something that's easier to carry, easier to manage.
I was going to ask, since yours is in three pieces, does that mean you're able to reorganize your board? Like, could you? Do you have the option to adjust the pieces into different forms that change the game scape?
No, the board pieces just fit in. You know, they're identical pieces, so they fit into a triangle of sorts. And the pieces themselves, the variations that you see in Klinzah are things like, okay, if you move in one variation, if you move a piece from one square to another, you have to put a marker on the square you moved off of, and for a period of time, nobody else can move onto that particular triangle, that particular space.
So you can't get outflanked as soon as you move.
Depending on things. And not only that, but your goal can be protected in most cases by whatever piece you feel you can put on top of it and protect your goal. And so while I'm saying that, and the goal of the game is to capture the other guy's goal, there is one of these variations. I think it's the perpetual game where there's only one goal between the two parties, and you keep the game going without ever losing your goal, which is the same goal as your opponent.
Oh my good. Well, that sounds very complicated.
That sounds complicated, doesn't it?
a never-ending game, and both of you have the same goal, and wow. sounds like chess through the mail.
Yeah. And they also talk in the book of different species games of this type. You had human ka, which was basically chess, and they referred to a ram ka known as Lakdran Kukol. I'm butchering that pronunciation, but it basically allowed Kern to read a Romulan attack, because the Romulans were using tactics that they use on that game to try and destroy the Klingon ships. And seeing that, he was able to give his captain a suggestion on how to win the battle, which ends up giving him the nickname that he has stuck to him for a while of Thought Ensign.
Okay, maybe we should move on a little bit, and unless there's any other characters or places or something we would like to discuss, maybe we should move on and have Sean lead us through our favorite points of plot.
Well, one thing you did talk about earlier was Winston Carter was brought in for negotiations where the Klingons, Kern in particular, were trying to negotiate with the Federation for the knowledge of how to use dilithium crystals to focus their antimatter energy to boost the power of their ships, to take them from beyond warp 5 and boost their weapons output.
Yeah, roughly he had to buy that information, though, didn't he?
Kern or Carter?
Kern.
Kern bought the information with information Kelly had accumulated that the Federation kind of wanted.
Yeah, so there was a lot of smoke-filled room dealings going on behind the scenes and things like that that, well, seemed to benefit everybody, but it also caused problems in the future.
doesn't everything?
Most definitely. So, Sean, you want to take us through our favorite points of plot?
All right, well, we kind of touched bases on what happened in Atlanta already. So I guess we'll move forward. One of my favorite points was the stepfather talking about the, I believe he referred to it as the perpetual game. I was curious what you guys, he never actually expressly says what it is, but I feel like he was talking about the idea that kind of life's a game and it keeps on going. I feel like he was trying to almost like mold somebody. Like he could see the end of himself coming, and he was almost like molding somebody by Kern to move, go on after him as like his new, you know, like playing him within the Klingon Empire is like playing the reflective game. So he's molding Kern into taking over the game for him and playing with the pieces of the Empire. What do you guys think? You think I'm on point with that, or?
Well, pretty much I thought the perpetual game had to do a lot with this is life. You're not going to win, lose, stop, start, yada, yada, yada. But life is going to go on. And how do you keep a detente that keeps everything moving, keeps everything flowing, and keeps life going?
What do you think, Jim?
I kind of agree with both of you. The entire book seemed to be a reflection of this game, where you had the perpetual game, which is people dealing with people all the time, never ending. And then, you know, you might have the clouded game with all the stuff that was going on behind the scenes, all the backhanded dealing and things like that. And the ablative game would be, you know, as the society, the various societies break each other down. And perhaps the ablative game might be equivalent to the earth only movement that was going on. Perhaps the entire book just kind of reflected the game, final reflection, and just different forms of the game were all going on at the same time.
Yeah, it's interesting that he was able to equate a lot of it back to the game. I am curious if he thought of the idea of the game first and wrote a book around the idea that these two guys kind of treat everything like a giant game board, and it's just about maneuvering everything into position. Or did he start off with the story, but he didn't have any sort of a catch, and that's where, or a hook to it, and that kind of came out of a way of telling the story was through this Klingon game itself.
Well, looking, you know, in retrospect, I can see this. Now, I did not see this at the time that I was reading the book, that the book was a reflection of the game. So now I have to think about this, because it just hit me just now.
Go for it.
What do you think, John?
Yes, very much so. Vern was taught the game. Vern was taught the game as a way to look at the world and navigate through the military, so that when he becomes Kern and starts rising within the military, he's got a war game to pattern his movements on and understand his opponents, and is given the ability to think two or three steps ahead of whoever it is he's playing against or working against. It's one of the things I think that in the middle of the book, where Akil, his second in command, is able to take over the ship briefly because Kern didn't see that particular move that his XO was going to make to him.
I think the author could have probably done a little bit better job pointing this out. Or maybe I just missed it, but I don't know.
I feel like, I it, Sorry. I was going to say, it's definitely one of these things where you need, it's an inferred thing where he sets up the idea in the first story, but because it's supposed to be more of an account rather, like, obviously Starfleet misses it, but when you read it, it's like, it seems more like it's somebody's personal account of it. The actual idea of it being the perpetual game is more inferred. And I think that's just a part of the way they framed it. It's my impression is when I got to the end of the book is this actually happened and none of it's been made up. And this guy had somebody on the inside of the Klingons. Maybe he actually talked to Kern himself or talked to one of Kern, or maybe he talked to Gilly. And Starfleet tries to write off the details as him just fluffing it out. So it becomes a story. But because Ford has decided to frame it as an actual first person's account of it, I think he had to set up the idea in such a way that you had to infer it by the end. I'm sorry, I might have completely lost my point there.
No, I don't think so. I think you stated it well, and it sounds viable.
And if it was anything other than something that the reader had to infer into the story, then basically you'd be having the author pulling out his mallet to pound his particular message into the reader.
Fair enough.
Guilty as charged.
Okay, so the next part that I really liked was when he got into the second ship was the Fencer, right?
The first ship we see Kern captaining is the Fencer. It's the second ship listed in the book. The first ship, I believe, the Blue Light.
So the Lancer was the second command. So I like the idea when he got into Lancer that they have like these rooms on each of the ships where they monitor the rest of the crew on behalf of the high command. I thought that was really a cool idea. To me, it feels more of a Romulan thing, but you know that I don't think the Romulans were quite there yet until Next Generation, where this does feel more Klingon from the TOS perspective. And I just kind of like the idea that the way they keep all these people in line is that you never know who's actually on your side. And they're trying to keep their crew in a constant state of fear by having this almighty monitoring room so that when he gets onto this room and they've pulled all the guts out, he's like, but everybody's going to stay in check because they don't know that we're not paying attention to them. This room's been repurposed for something completely different.
Do you mean to say that if you don't want something overheard, then don't say it?
I just thought it was interesting that they would have something like that. And it does feel very Cold War-like and submarine-ish the way he explains it all, which is kind of a result of the time when the original series was made.
In the original series, Kor monitored everything from his office on Organia. So I don't think it's unprecedented.
And the quote that I gave you earlier was right out of the book, first part of the book, when the Thought Admiral was training Vern, if you don't want something heard, don't say it.
I remember that.
I think that's the lesson for using social media. We have a lot of issues with that at work.
fair point, you bet. If you don't want it out there, don't put it out there.
Actually, I should point out, because John Haverson mentioned this as he noticed on his current reading of the book, as one of his favorite plot points was the reference to the Klingon Twilight Zone. A quote from the book from Dr. Emmanuel Tagore on page 94 of my version anyway, was from the galactic Bermuda Triangle to the Klingon Twilight Zone, where he was referring to ships disappearing completely with no survivors and nobody knows what happens to them. But golly gee, it must be the Klingons.
Which harkens back to the Federation, of course, and being the good guys and the Klingons being the bad guys as it was in original series.
And that Bermuda Triangle thing is also another animated series reference. When the first appearances of the Klingons in that, they ended up on, in some sort of space Bermuda Triangle, and I'm almost 100% sure that that's the exact that's what they called it in the animated series as well.
Well, in the 70s and 80s, the legend of the Bermuda Triangle was big. In fact, they made a TV series. I can't remember the name of it. I think Inside the Bermuda Triangle or something along that lines.
Oh, yeah. I remember all of that Bermuda Triangle stuff. I mean, it, as John said, it was big news in the 70s and 80s.
I'm more referring to what they actually called it in the episode. I know John just said it, but it completely went over my head. Not the Bermuda Triangle, but they referred it to as in the book.
In the book, they referred to it, he referred to from the galactic Bermuda Triangle to the Klingon Twilight Zone.
Oh, okay. My mistake.
A big case of finger pointing.
And it becomes a plot point in the last third of the book, in that the military leaders, the admirals that are trying to keep the Federation together, keep Starfleet together, needs a boogeyman on the border to keep the inner planets in line, to keep funding ships. And flip that around, you've got Klingons that are doing staged raids that are being made to look like other races to try and keep the Federation off board, not so much off board as off kilter, off center, just a little bit off.
Oh, fair enough. I thought you were referring to the Delta Triangle. That's the name of what I was thinking of.
Nope. So if we look at the last conflict that Kern goes through, it literally is those a faction of Klingons that want to keep the border skirmishes going, sending a squadron, three ships, to go and destroy an Earth colony or destroy a Federation colony so that the Federation still has an enemy to keep the fleet together, so they have somebody to antagonize, to piss off, to fight with.
Yeah, that was an interesting reveal near the end about how he was very aware of it the whole time, and he was gonna stop the last real one. Is there any plot points that you like, Jordan?
Well, it's always nice to see how a society is imagined when the world is built for the book. In this case, unfortunately, we spent more time on Earth than we did on the Klingon homeworld. So John Ford didn't get a chance to put a lot of Klingon society together, but we did get to see the genteel side / living side on Earth of that time period.
Yeah, it was interesting to see the human side of it. And I found the summit, both of them were kind of interesting. The first one was more of a military thing, and the second one was more of a Federation thing. And them having to take appointments and talk to people and try to figure out what's going on, how they're going to react to things, trying to figure out what's going on in the background, putting up feelers and stuff like that. That was all pretty interesting. I thought it was kind of cool that he was hiding how he was going in and out of the planet and doing side missions and all that stuff. It was all the Earth and the Federation stuff was pretty cool, but it would have been nice to see more of the Klingon side of it, especially since Emil was supposed to be there for years, and they don't even show one meeting between him and the Klingons.
But I think that would have brought into play at least another novel, if not multiples.
What about you, Jim? Any more favorite plot points?
I really enjoyed the opening part of the book, watching the game of Klingon being played and how Vern was very successful, caught the attention of a Thought admiral, and was actually adopted and raised and trained through the game of Klinzah, how to think and how to strategize and growing up. Overall, that was probably my favorite part of the book, and I would have been really happy just seeing the rest of the book develop and build on that from a Klingon perspective rather than bringing in the Federation to it. Of course, that would have defeated the point of the whole book, but at the same time, I was hoping for more development on the Klingon side of things.
Yeah, one of the big, at least I feel like between you and me, one of the disappointments kind of stems from, as influential as people say this story is, that there a lot of time is actually spent on Earth and with the Federation rather than with the Klingons.
Well, I'm really glad they pulled out what Klingon parts were there to create the organization of CAG and preserve some of the things like the rank names and things like that. I appreciate that a great deal.
Anything else you guys got for plot points?
Did you notice in the book we see the first mention of the honorifics?
Yeah, so that, and there's also, isn't this supposed to be the first mention of the Black Fleet too?
Based on the time that this book came out and the other things that were available, I don't think, when did Star Trek The Next Generation launch?
87, I think.
So this would definitely have been long before, I thought it was earlier than 87.
Next Generation?
Yeah, Next Generation.
Give me a second.
But there's no mention of the Black Fleet in the original series or at least the first three movies.
I don't recall the Black Fleet coming up until Discovery, as a matter of fact, at least as far as TV or movies are concerned.
No, we actually had Taurus on one of the ships in the Black Fleet being taken to Greythor.
Ah.
1987, September 28th was the premiere.
I'm sorry, September what?
September 28th, 1987.
Okay, so that puts this book well before we saw any of Worf's Klingons or the three Klingons that came on board and we first saw the death ceremony.
Yeah, Heart of Glory. That was a good episode.
Yes, it was. That's where we first see Von Armstrong. Well, I suppose we could move on and talk about themes. I think I found about three different themes, and you guys can add to that as we go along. One theme that was pretty obvious was preventing war. Another one that I picked out of here that I really, really enjoyed was Klingons as an honorable race as opposed to stock villains on TOS, and learning language as a window into another race's ways of thinking. What do you guys think of those?
Learning a language as learning a culture is the whole basis for the Klingon Language Institute and why they're creating the Klingon language and the way they're doing it the way they are to get a look at how this society could be set up. So yeah, that's very much a real point.
Sean, did you come up with any themes that struck you in this book?
Nothing that hasn't been mentioned already. Like the whole perpetual game thing we were talking about earlier.
Yeah, I think most of the themes that we can see running through this book, whether it's the prevention of war or the honorable society or the interactions with your comrades. We even see a little bit of race purity on the Klingon side in when they talk about the fusions. But that all gets wrapped around this chess game of the Klingons, Klinzah. So we all see how that fits in. All these themes fit in through that particular lens.
I almost forgot about the fusions. It's interesting how they're dealt with within the book, because it's fusions don't come up the way people view fusions doesn't, it never really came up too much until like the reimagining of the original series, and they delve more into how Spock was treated as he was a kid, and in Discovery they're dealing with Michael Burnham. So it was it almost slipped my mind because of watching Discovery, really, that this book also dealt with how the Klingons dealt with fusions, and it's interesting to see how integrated they are into their population, yet how outcasted they are at the same time.
It's why Kelly could never have a relationship with Kern, even though you get the feeling they're both trying to pursue it.
Even when you flash forward to Deep Space Nine, the fact that Alexander is a mixed breed never seems to be the issue that the crew ever had with him. It's more just his general incompetence. And even when it came to B'Elanna, like, she talked about her conflicted her confliction internally, but it was more of a regurgitation of Spock, of a Klingon instead of a Vulcan. But they never really addressed, there was never really an addressment of how her being a fusion, I guess is the word they use, really played into the series at all, where this book does address it a little bit more. It'd be cool to see a little bit more of it. Like, you don't see too much of it in Star Trek, of like, we have Spock and we have now Michael Burnham, though she's not really a fusion, the literal sense of it, more of in a cultural sense, and B'Elanna, you don't, and Alexander, you really don't see too many characters like that.
Yeah, and don't forget Kalar, though.
Oh, well, yeah, otherwise Alexander couldn't be one.
And she would have experienced it more than B'Elanna would have, but I think also we have to look at the fact that this book was written before those themes were started to be brought up in Trek. And Ford probably had contractual obligations of areas where he couldn't go, areas that he couldn't explore. Otherwise, Trek later couldn't explore them.
Yeah, I don't have a copy of the book in front of me. I would be interested to know if CBS licensed this book. And yeah, I don't know.
It would have been before CBS owned it. It would have been licensed by either probably Paramount, because Paramount would have been making the movies at the same time through Pocketbook on the licensing forever for novels.
This book is published for Pocketbooks, a division of Simon & Schuster, Inc., under exclusive license from Paramount Pictures Corporation, the trademark owner.
There you go.
Okay, so then they would have had to approve everything that was in there before it was released.
Well, it just depends on what sort of mandate Paramount gave to Pocketbook or Schuster. They might not, like, I always, like, the books sometimes feel like they have a lot of latitude, and that might be because they're just, they kind of, under this blanket directive of nothing can change. By the end of the book, everything has to be back to normal.
Well, and none of the books are canon. Absolutely none of them are canon, according to CBS and Paramount and the authors themselves. So the authors have a wide latitude to play in, but the only thing that is considered canon is what has been on the screen.
I thought Imzadi was canon.
None of the Star Trek books are canon. That's one of the big problems that fans of Star Trek who don't read the books, that's one of their problems, why they don't bother to read the books, because they aren't canon.
Well, for anybody who is listening to this who hasn't read any of the books, I find that the canon of the Star Trek books is about on par with the canon of the Star Wars books, because Star Wars books have been contradicted tons of times, and George Lucas made up like this scale of continuity where basically the most recent, if two materials contradict each other, the most recent one trumps. It's the same thing with Star Trek. If it's been contradicted with it, well, just pretend the timeline erased it.
Actually, with the Star Wars books, Lucas was always putting down a plot outline that the writers had to follow, the Star Trek authors didn't have to follow that same type of plot line, but there were certain restrictions that they had to go by. As far as canon is concerned, none of the books, comics, or whatever of Star Trek were ever considered canon. For a while, the Star Wars were, but then when Disney took over, they decanonized everything that had come before the purchase except the films and TV shows.
That's precisely my understanding of the way things are.
There's an article on one of the wikis about the canon of Star Wars, and you'll see what I'm talking about. They've routinely contradicted themselves tons of times, and basically when George Lucas made up this level of canon type of thing, so that to justify having things that contradict each other without to his fans. And to me, the way our canon works is pretty much on the same level as it is, that if there's something newer that contradicts an older book, then the book didn't happen. That's just as simple as that.
Well, the current Star Trek authors, and we're getting off into a tangent here, but the current Star Trek authors pay very, very close attention to each other, and to make sure that if, for instance, David Mack kills off a character, that character doesn't appear later in one of Dayton Ward's books. There is the editor at Pocket Books that keeps very close track and reads everything before the licenses go out to write the books, to make sure that we aren't stepping on our own toes. And some of the books are just, I mean, they follow logically on from the point where the series may have left off, but they still are not considered to be according to Hoyle.
Now, that being said, this latest series, one of the writers who is on the TV series writing staff is only there to be a liaison with the novel writers, because they would like to start having books that actually have impact on the storyline. So like the first book that they wrote, Desperate Hours, they worked very closely with that writer so that they wanted him to explore reasons why Discovery's level of technology isn't lining up with, or the uniforms and stuff aren't lining up with the original series, and explore her relationship with Spock and why they would have a strange relationship. A plug for other show, we talk about it quite a bit in the historical records. I mentioned a few times about some of the stuff that was mentioned in Desperate Hours that justifies the changes to the continuity and the canon of Discovery in the original series.
I am currently reading Desperate Hours, and the author is David Mack, and I'm not very far through it yet, but I am appreciating what I'm seeing in there. And it would be nice if the two lines, the on-screen lines and the literary lines, would kind of come together and match up and complement each other a little more than they do now.
They said that's a big goal with the comic books as well. The first one, which I think might have been, is being released tomorrow, if the latest date that I saw was correct. Star Trek Discovery comic book series isn't going to be so much a series kind of like traditional ones where it's a continuing storyline. They said Star Trek is going to start off as a series of miniseries where it's like, okay, the first one being Takuma. So it's like, okay, now we have six episodes explaining who Takuma was, and this is going to be who he actually was. Like they don't plan to contradict anything that's in the comic book.
Sounds like I'm going to be making a trip to the comic store tomorrow.
I'll let you know if it's there when I go by myself.
All right. Well, we're getting a little long on the show. Maybe we should move into our closing thoughts on the final reflection. John, you want to take this?
Well, this book was written in 1984. That was the same year that Star Trek III came out. That was the same. That was the movie that Mark Okrand was developing the Klingon language for. So actually, if it was, it would be possible, this book could actually use a updating of its Klingon language. But then again, John's not around. John Ford died, and he's not around to make those corrections. So this particular novel is going to have to stand as it is. And I think this novel does stand the way it is, understanding that it is a reflection by a human of events that he probably didn't have complete privy to or even exacting memory to. Anyone else?
Yeah, I was just going to say, Sean, do you have any closing thoughts?
I'd say despite all the negative things I had, I'd still recommend this book for its cultural impact, not only on Klingons, but mainly on Keg, to give some people an insight to see where Keg's influences come from. I would suggest this book. On a more random note, just more because I did this, I'm just going to put the results out there. I'd ask how many people had actually read the book on the Keg podcast Facebook page. And of 34 votes, 68% said they had read it.
Interesting.
68% is a pretty good number of people to have read the book.
I think this book would bear, for me at least, a second look. And maybe this summer when life slows down a little bit for a while after school gets out, I think I may read this one again and see if I can gain a little better appreciation of what's in it, especially with this conversation that we've had this evening, because I think I've gotten a lot of insight into things that I missed, and I want to give it a real fair chance.
That's an interesting idea to mainly you and me to try reading again, maybe after a few more books from the same series, try reading this again and see if we have more of an appreciation for what it is. You'll have to let me know when you read it again, and I'll try reading again too.
Fair enough.
Do we know what book we're reading next? I believe we're going to be rotating your selections. I think, is this Jorn's month or is it Jim's month?
Well, John picked this one, I think. And
correct.
And then I went with...
How Much for Just the Planet?
That's it. The other John Ford book.
That's correct.
That's an interesting place to start. As far as I know, he only wrote two Klingon eccentric books, so it'd be interesting to see how he builds on what he's already established from the Klingon culture and see if he takes advantage of that and if he explores it more.
And I think Halvorsen recommended this book as our second book.
Oh, well, then we can't go wrong there.
And I never mentioned that to him, so that's out of the blue.
Oh, nice. Yeah, it seems like a good place to start, really, with it. If we're covering Klingon-eccentric books, it's, I guess, the best place to always start is at the beginning.
So how would we rate this current book, let's say on a scale of 1 to 5?
Well, to pull a quote out of the book and modify it a bit, a pleasant book, my compliments to a worthy author.
So is that a 5?
Probably 4.5 to 5, yeah. Okay. The end line of any Klingon game is you turn to the person that you are playing with and say, a pleasant game, my compliments to a worthy opponent.
That seems very genteel for Klingons.
Yes, that's why I thought it was kind of a reflective statement of looking at their culture, if that's actually, you know, what they're saying. Now, they may say it a different way today, but that's just a translation that comes from it.
That's an interesting idea.
All right, I am going to give this book 3 stars at this time and reserve the right to change it later.
I'm going to second that 3.
So that means you're giving it a 6 or a 9.
It's still just a 3.
But you seconded it. I didn't know if you multiplied it by 2 or took it to the square.
I got nothing.
Our combined rating then would be a 3.5 out of 5 for this book.
Somewhere in there, yeah.
And if you're listening to this, why don't you tell us what you would rate it out of 5?
And how do they get a hold of us there, Sean?
Well, they can leave a comment on the Keg website. You can look for our Facebook page, Keg Podcast, one word. We're on Twitter, Keg Podcast. We're on Instagram, Keg Podcast. And we're on Imgur, again, Keg Podcast. It's pretty easy to remember. And then there's podcast@keg.org is our email address. It's simple for me. I get confused easily.
I'm Jorn.
I'm Javon.
And I'm Judge M. And join us next time on Bound by Honor. Kapla.
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 You have been listening to Bound by Honor, the Klingon Assault Group Book Review Podcast. Bound by Honor is brought to you by the Klingon Assault Group and is produced by Admiral Kirk Zantai Loon Keej. If you hear the call of the warrior, visit our homepage at www.kag.org to learn more about what it means to be Klingon. Perhaps you have what it takes to be one of us. Listener feedback is always welcome at podcast@kag.org. Kaplop!